Account for the Blind. I'm Brian McCallum. On a previous episode of this program, you may remember my interview with Alan Locke. He was the former British Royal Navy officer who was diagnosed with macular degeneration in 2003. But that didn't stop Alan from becoming the first visually impaired person to row across the Atlantic Ocean. And Alan became the first visually impaired man to trek from Antarctica to the South Pole. Alan and the Polar Vision team have just released a YouTube documentary about the Arctic experience from beginning to end. Alan returns to Speaking Out for the Blind to talk about the film, how to watch the documentary, and play some clips for us. Welcome back, Alan.
Hi, Brian. Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Well, welcome back to the show. On a previous episode of the program, you told our listeners about the Polar Vision expedition from Antarctica to the South Pole. The Polar Vision team filmed a documentary about that experience. Alan, what inspired you and the team to film a documentary about that expedition?
When we originally set ourselves a challenge, the aim was threefold, which, you know, for sure it was an ambition that we all had, and I wanted to do that in spite of my sight impairment. Secondly, we wanted to financially support the two charities we were involved in, which was Guide Dogs for the Blind, very close to you in the Bay Area, and Sight Savers International, which is based in the UK but operates around the world. And thirdly, to raise awareness of sight impairment, but also inspire those who have a sight impairment to to show they can still pursue their dreams. And this falls into that third category. And we were very fortunate that just literally as we were about to start the expedition, one of Richard's friends, a chap called Matt Peters, who is a freelance filmmaker and journalist, was able to sort of step forward and say, hey, if you guys get some footage, I'll be able to put this all together. He was able to do a bit of filming for us, and he had a little bit of funding to put a short documentary together. And so we thought this would be a fantastic idea. It's great to sort of raise awareness, and it we thought it'd be really interesting for for people, whether they're visually impaired or not.
I'm curious if any of the team had film or video production experience, and what training you and the team did in filming, or for that matter, did you all do any sort of acting training?
We definitely didn't have any acting training, so we're either very bad actors or I guess we never sort of came across our minds, but none of the team have any experience, and it was really down to Matt to help us. And I mean, the advice he gave us was, he wouldn't be on the ice with us, so he said, just be as natural as you can. It'll be obvious if it's very staged, and clearly we're trying to show what it was actually like and the actual feelings we had at that time. It would defeat the point to try and sort of stage anything. So we got a few tips on how to hold the cameras and things like that. But generally, so just be yourself, get as much footage as possible. And he was able to film us departing and to do some pre-interviews. But the bulk of it, the footage, is really just what we took on a combination of the flip video cameras, iPhones and the like. So Matt did a really good job trying to pull it all together.
Great. So now let's go behind the scenes into this film. I understand that you and the other team members, Richard Smith, Andrew Jensen, and Hannah McKing, did the filming in the South Pole. How did you four film with the camera while focusing on the challenging endeavor?
The short answer for me is I didn't, but I guess that would have been that's better for the camera quality. But it also got me, it was another piece, another responsibility I could delegate onto the other guys. But I think the footage fell into two categories. There was the filming that we did actually outside on the ice as we were going along in various types of weather. And Richard and Andrew really took the sort of lead on that, and obviously they had to be fairly cognizant of when they could balance getting some really good footage with, you know, the safety aspect, because the last thing they want to do is take, and you know, one layer of gloves off to be able to handle a camera a little bit better, and then that caused them a problem. So there was that side, but actually the most interesting side and was actually a real kind of was very enjoyable to do was the sections where we were able to film inside the tent, because at the end of the day we were, you know, relatively comfortable, we just had some food, and just being able to talk about how we felt, whether it was tough going or not. And for us, it was a great opportunity to capture that moment where you either felt, you know, really jazzed and elated that perhaps you hit some milestone, or else you're having a kind of tough time, but you could kind of express how that felt. So yeah, I think it was, in summary, it was a challenge to always be disciplined to get the footage. But Matt had said to us, like, get as much as you can, because you can always leave you can always leave bits on the cutting room floor, but you can never, you know, you can never go back and get more footage. But also, it was a great way for us to try and get our thoughts down on video as we went along.
Now, I understand that Matt Peters filmed the beginning of the film in the place where the Polar Vision team started the expedition, Punta Arenas, Chile. Tell me more about Matt and how he helped you and the rest of the Polar Vision team film the documentary in this area of the world.
Yeah, so Matt is, Matt's a good friend of all of us now, but we knew him via Richard, and he'd done some work for a variety of institutions, one of which was Dartmouth College, where Richard happened to be at the time, and he's also done some work with other charities. And I believe he's currently based in New York, where he continues as a freelance journalist. And what Matt came with us down to Chile, which is the staging post before we flew off to Antarctica. Matt was very keen to get some very detailed interviews with us, and we met up with Matt at this warehouse where a lot of our food and a lot of the Arctic gear was being stored before we sent off. And I think Matt looked around there and thought, this is perfect, because, you know, you had some oil drums in the background and lots of Antarctic gear around and sort of pallets of food. It just sort of looked good. So he sat us down there, did a lot of filming with myself, Richard, Hannah and Andrew. And that was the time, I think, where he tried to get to the point of saying, well, why are you doing this? What's the reason behind it? And particularly for me, asking, well, how do you feel when you lost a lot of your sight, and what's the journey been that's got you from there to wanting to do this? It came out really well. I mean, it's all testament to Matt, and he did a great job.
So now, Alan, I'm going to ask you about portions of the film, and then I'm going to play those clips for all of the listeners out there. Let's start at the point just before you and the team started the journey. After you and the team landed in Chile and flew to the Union Glacier in Antarctica, as you all flew to Chile, everybody on the team felt mixed emotions. Why was this the case? And what will our listeners hear in this clip?
I think this is the portion where we actually fly into Antarctica, I guess. Yeah, I think there's sort of mixed emotions in the sense that obviously all really excited, and we've had 2 years of preparation and training. It's all come to this. So you're, on the one hand, you're really excited, you're raring to get going. But on the other hand, obviously you're stepping into the unknown. And I think all of us, when we were very honest with each other, our biggest fear, it wasn't so much that we'd get very serious frostbite or there'd be, God forbid, some awful incident. And clearly that's a risk, but it was, you've done everything to mitigate it. But actually the biggest fear was all of us didn't want to do something which would, let down your teammates. So, for example, I was really worried about, because of my sight, either sort of falling and injuring myself or perhaps you know, screwing up and letting one of the tents blow away, that kind of thing. And I think the others felt the same. So it was that mixed emotions of excitement on the one hand, but then wariness about the unknown. You know, I think you can, most people can appreciate that from anything new that they're perhaps trying.
Okay, let's play it.
So we're filming ourselves now. We're there with a bunch of people who look a lot more prepared and a lot more hardcore than we were.
You have this sort of big mixture of emotions, a combination of excitement, happiness, and a bit of nerves as well. As soon as our feet were down on the ground, we felt that elation of finally setting foot on this continent where not that many people get the chance to go.
Kind of like expected. It's very beautiful and very cold.
Of course, the wind is blowing 40 miles an hour. It's 35 below.
We were picked up by these pretty beefy looking SUVs with special terrain tracks. We had a quick 10-minute drive to the to base camp.
It was kind of late, so we tried to go to bed, but I think we were all a little bit too excited to sleep.
Within 9 to 10 minutes of the film, the real adventure started as you and the rest of the team started that first day of trekking to the South Pole. Let's talk about that first day. You walked through lumps of snow, found blisters on your feet, and even conducted taste tests with frozen food, including, correct me if I'm wrong, granola bars to see if your teeth didn't shatter, and assembled camp and took breaks in the cold weather. Explain these first challenges, and describe what our listeners are going to hear.
Yeah, so I think the first day was full of lots of challenges, not just in terms of skiing in Antarctica, but also the day-to-day tasks you alluded to there. So you always think of Antarctica as really flat, but actually it can be quite lumpy in place, which is a sort of challenge for me. And then as you alluded to, we had we obviously don't have any fresh food there. We've got to take it all with us. We found the granola bars that we took, despite our best efforts, would be sort of frozen solid as a brick. So you'd always be a bit wary about chewing those off in case one of your teeth came out with it. But luckily, you know, that didn't seem to happen to anyone. And then finally, yeah, in the evenings, you were able to sort of set up camp, have our first night in the tent, and get used to boiling our food up. And I guess, you know, some of your listeners may have used similar food. It's, you know, the type of stuff you might get in kind of camping stores, but it's dehydrated, you know, a bit of pasta and meat, you boil the water and put it in there. So it's not the tastiest stuff in the world, but it's packed full of calories. We'd have to do this. And it was, yeah, I guess that sort of first section of going through that for the first day, that you knew you were going to have to do that cycle many, many days afterwards. So it was really just trying to fitting it out and getting used to it.
Okay, let's play the clip.
We had 6 75-minute marches every day. Richard, Hannah, and I would take turns leading.
I wasn't navigating for obvious reasons. So whoever's in taking the lead, I would be tucked in behind them.
Navigation is made harder by the fact that there are no landmarks to aim at. You just basically find a lump of snow, and then you aim for that lump of snow. And you can't look down, because as soon as you look up again, you've lost your lump of snow.
I remember, as we were skiing along, constantly having to adjust my clothing, get everything comfortable, never quite sure if you're going to start to overheat. Once you start to sweat, you're in real trouble, because that freezes on you.
We were stopping constantly on the first day to sort of check pressure points on our feet and make sure that we weren't blistering.
You would stop, you'd put on your big down jacket because you'd cool down very quickly. So you'd get out your little grab bag of snacks for that day. They'd freeze and you had to sort of snap bits off and hope your teeth didn't shatter when you did it.
It was never a relaxed meal. It was always stop, sit on your pole, grab your bag, grab your thermos flask. It was a refueling stop.
So as you finish the last march, we would find a suitable patch of ground. We would break off into our two pairs, and then we had our own specific jobs to help with the tent up. For myself, given my situation, I was perhaps not doing the more jobs, which are contingent on great eyesight. So a lot of the time I would be on latrine duty. But putting up the tents would take maybe 10, 15 minutes, to get everything all bedded in.
And the first day, we've done 15 and a bit miles today. I've got a blister already, and my back. But
it's one thing for it to be cold outside. It's another thing to feel like all of Antarctica is just advancing on you in this steady wall. I mean, it blows through zippers. If your shirt is untucked, it works its way in there. It kind of gets everywhere.
It is very windy. I'm getting back in the tank.
In order to ensure that we had that connection in the evening, so we didn't split off into little groups for dinner, we would tend to go around each other's houses, so to speak.
What the hell is there, Richard?
This is pate. This is just fat.
What are you putting it on?
It's fat on Pringles.
What kind of Pringles?
They're here comes Alan.
He's a friendly face. Look at that big smile.
Talk me through your dinner. What you got there?
It's Norwegian food, army food. Very nice. It's chicken curry. Just
I enjoy the dirty socks.
Just to keep it all. I've been wearing those for 3 days now. Hannah, what are you doing?
Somebody peed on one of the steps.
We're looking at Andrew for that.
I didn't pee on the step.
What are you eating, Andrew?
Green bag.
I like green bag.
Man, I eat green bag every day. It's my favorite. It's the same thing I had yesterday, beef and potato stew. The secret ingredient is 250 grams of butter.
Well, yesterday I was so keen just to get some fresh water, I just picked up a lump of snow and started eating it. Probably doesn't do you any good.
So talk to us about the onset of polar madness then, Alan.
After landing at base camp in Antarctica, you and the Polar Vision team practiced survival training and finished organizing all of your supplies. How did you complete these two tasks, and what will our listeners hear in this piece?
So, for me personally, I think survival training for being able to live and work in Antarctica was critical, clearly, to all of us. But for me, it was obviously quite a challenge. I had the added barrier of my sight impairment, and a lot of it was around how to dress properly, and also when we were putting up tents and shelter, I obviously couldn't see anything of detail, and like the other guys, it's difficult also to use the sensors that you would use in everyday life. It's difficult to feel things because you've got hard gloves on. So for me, it was tough, and I would have to have a very kind of specific kind of role and know what to do in any circumstances. So we would we did a lot of training around that, and obviously everyone was very conscious of my sight, and I wanted to have as much responsibility as possible, but clearly there's some things that would be a challenge and I would need a bit of a hand with. But it was kind of really critical to do that and held us in good stead. With regards to the second point around just finally organising our remaining supplies, so we had a lot of this was done in Chile, but when we were out there, we spent a lot of time sort of packing and repacking our sleds, which had everything in there, our food and clothing, et cetera, putting in fuel. The huge amount of time actually just sort of separating out the food. And it's not just carrying the food with you, but it's also just how you lay it out on the sled. If you can imagine, the sled is like a massive big holder or big bag. And when you stop, say for a break during the day, it can be in very bad conditions. If you want to sort of reach in and get your your chocolate bar or whatever, it's got to be pretty near the top. And you've got to sort of think about this all the way around. Where do I put certain items to get them at certain times? And, you know, there's a million and one things to think about. And it really being prepared and having that attention to detail when you're planning and your preparation was crucial, because it was easier to do it then when you're at base camp and it's relatively relaxed, rather than have to worry about it when you're actually several hundred miles into Antarctica and potentially it's much more handy.
Okay, let's play it.
And let me start by saying happy Thanksgiving to everyone back home.
We're not gonna start walking for another couple of days. So we're just pulling all together the last bits of prep.
Alan, what are you doing?
You filming or taking a picture?
No, I'm filming. No, I'm just curious.
Nothing about how you're doing.
So one of the things we did when we were in camp, we had an afternoon where we could put the skis on.
We're out here about, a kilometre from Union Glacier. And we're practicing putting up the tents. The idea is we've split into our two pairs. So myself and Hannah and Andrew and Richard. And we're both practicing putting up the tents.
I really need to know exactly where the little islets were and exactly where I put the peg, and trying to remember that and being able to do it just through feel a lot of the time. With the added constraint that obviously you're perhaps working with very hefty gloves and, you know, you don't want to expose your skin.
When it's 40 below, exposed skin freezes within 30 seconds. So you really need to be able to get that tent up as soon as possible. It becomes a matter of life or death for you.
As we were coming back, we saw one of the planes come into base camp.
I guess that plane symbolized both the start point in terms of, yeah, this is what's going to get us to the start, we can crack on, but also a bit of melancholy as well, because we knew once that plane set us down and it went, you know, we're on our own and the real thing had begun.
7 o'clock in the evening. We need to get out there. We need to start burning off some of this weight we've been putting on.
Speak for yourself.
I struggle to see too much out of the windows other than wideness. I know Andrew and Rich were taking photographs.
It just looks like the rest of Antarctica, but you're looking over the ocean. It's 100 feet of ice on the ocean. And somewhere hundreds of miles beyond it is the South Pole, you know, and that's the dream. That's the finish. That's the goal. Landed, didn't have a lot of time, threw the sleds out.
We are on the Filchner Ice Shelf. You can't really tell, but we're above water right now. This is technically the coast of Antarctica. This is where we're starting from.
And then it fired up the prop and it flew away.
At about 15 minutes into the film, you and the Polar Vision team walk through the snow in very cold and foggy conditions. The members of the team explained how you navigated in the snow. Talk about some of their explanations and what our viewers are going to be hearing in this clip.
When you're navigating in perfect conditions, then it's sort of relatively simple because you can pick a point on the horizon, and whoever's at the front will have this compass set, and they can just sort of float on the course, and you can see each other, or at least the other guys can see each other from, you know, probably a kilometre away. It's not so much drama. When it was really bad conditions, then what we needed to do was to be able to stick much closer to the group, and these are occasions where I would have, whether it's Hannah or Richard, basically sitting next to me, helping to guide me, and whoever is at the front, which would be quite close, they would have the compass, which they would have on a special kind of bracket in front of them, and that you have to sort of take moving very sort of short sections and always be conscious of where the team was. So we were much closer than we were at other times in the expedition. And I think the key thing, as always, it was down to sort of teamwork and making sure you were looking out for each other, and that was particularly important when you had the bad weather.
Yeah. Okay, let's play it.
That, yeah, is skin.
How does it feel?
It doesn't feel great.
It's morning. It's December at the bottom of the world, baby, and I'm sizzling.
So sleeping in Antarctica is like falling asleep inside a backpack.
That is all the stuff I slept with tonight. Last night.
Andrew, how you feeling?
I'm in kind of a bad mood today.
Why is that?
I'm starting to get prune feet a little bit, which means my socks have been wet, so I'm going to kind of dry them out a little bit as we cook. It's going to be super fun.
As soon as there was a cloud between us and the sun, temperature dropped 25 degrees.
Really, the challenge for myself was not so much in trying to follow the person in front. The contrast is good enough if someone's wearing a red jacket against a white, then I can see a kind of blob and I know it's going out of direction. The real problem is I can't see any detail on the surface.
It's basically like throwing all the furniture in your living room all over the place, blindfolding yourself, and then walking across it. We were pathetic. It was at the end of those days that I had the most respect for Alan, because every day was a whiteout day for him.
Often I would have Andrew, Richard, or Hannah next to me, just guiding me and literally saying, you know, dip coming up, move to the left, watch out for this. Without having that guidance there, if we'd have been quite unlucky, that could have resulted in, you know, twisted ankle and then obviously game over.
I fell down and I broke my other ski pole in two.
First of all, we need to get out of the wind. There's no way we were going to be able to do any kind of work unless we were away from it. We kept a big orange tarp with us for that purpose. My pole was hollow inside, so we put the tent pole inside to brace it from the inside, and then we taped another pole on the outside to brace it on the outside.
Well, we're halfway through the day.
Then one more day, and we got a rest day.
Okay, so I'm wondering how our listeners can view the Polar Vision documentary. Just how can the audience watch it?
Okay, so I guess there's two ways, and I would say as well that although clearly there's video there, we've tried to put as much voiceover in as possible, and a lot of it is interviews, even if you are unable to view it visually. Hopefully, right, it should be very enjoyable listening to the audio. Two ways are to go to our website, which is www.polar-vision.org, or with the Polar Vision channel on YouTube. And frankly, if you just Google it as well, it's probably going to pop up in the beginning.
So real quickly, before we go, you got any plans for the future in terms of expeditions or adventures?
Well, it's tougher now that I'm married, so nothing on that scale, but I am training to try and swim the English Channel.
Wow.
Which is swimming from the coast of England to France, about 22 miles. So hopefully getting permission from my wife to do it, but yeah, no big huge challenge. I think the next really big one will be having kids, which is going to be expensive and challenging, but also rewarding.
Very much so. So, Alan, the information that you provided on today's show and this amazing documentary of you and your team's adventure might just inspire some of our listeners to trek the extra mile and explore the world. Thanks for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
That's all for this edition of Speaking Out for the Blind. Thanks for listening. And remember to speak out.
You are listening to American Council for the Blind Radio.
For the blind. For the blind.